Today on Idea Tellers.
We must be curious about the way other people do things, right? Why do they do it that way, not my way, right? We have to practice self-inquiry and then have the courage to raise our hand to ask questions, because the more diverse the questions or inputs, the more innovative the output. We must be willing to be very improvisational, which means to be experimental.
Need more innovation in your team? Our guest will tell you how to implement it. Dr. Natalie Nixon is a world authority on creativity. She's the president of Figure 8 Thinking and a global speaker. Her most recent book, The Creativity Leap, is all about practical ways to adopt innovation and creativity into our lives, businesses, and organizations. You're in for a treat, mi gente. This is Idea Tellers. Hola, mi gente. Bienvenidos. Welcome to another episode of Idea Tellers podcast. Today, we have an authority on the field of innovation and creativity, and I would like to welcome Dr. Natalie Nixon to Igno Latino Podcast. Bienvenida, doctora. Welcome.
Muchas gracias, Gonzalo. Yo no hablo mucho español, pero yo entiendo un poquito. Gracias.
Y lo habla muy bien, doctora. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background? And the reason why I want to do that is because you didn't set out to be a world authority in creativity, am I right?
You are correct. I did not set out to be a world authority in creativity. You know, I think when I was a little girl, like first or second grade, when people would ask, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Again, I'm a Libra, and so to this day, I remain very indecisive. But even back then, there were three things I thought I would want to be: a nurse, a writer, or a dancer. And I thought maybe there's a way I could do all three. And I'm still dancing, and I write a lot for my work. But it turned out the sight of blood was too much for me, so I did not pursue a career in medicine or healthcare. But, you know, I have a really loopy background. I have a background in cultural anthropology and fashion, as well as academia. And academia, my expertise was developed in the area of design thinking and applied innovation, human-centered innovation. And I credit my parents for gifting me, when I was in college, the permission to follow my heart. It was a tremendous gift, because I often tell people, you know, I don't come from financial wealth. I think we have other sources of wealth in our family, but it's not financial wealth. So it wasn't like I knew I would go work for the family company or I would have a trust fund one day. But when I was a second year of college, you have to declare your major. And I called home really worried. And I was close to tears. And I said, I don't know what to major in. I don't know what to study. I don't want to disappoint you. I want to make sure I get a good job when I graduate from college. Because they sacrificed a lot for our education.
Yes.
And they're listening to me. And then they said, what are you like? What are you interested in? And I didn't even want to answer the question. So I started saying, well, you know, I tried economics, but I almost failed. And political science is so boring. And sociology just reduces people to a bunch of statistics. They said, what do you like? What are you interested in? So then really shyly, I said, well, I really love my anthropology classes and this Africana studies program. It's so cool. And almost at the same time, my parents said, that's what you should study. And I said, what? I was like, wait a minute. Are you sure? I said, so you'll be okay if I study anthropology and maybe have a double major in Africana studies? And they said, yeah. And my father said, if you follow your heart, you study what you love, you'll have to turn down opportunities. And it was like this load lifted off of me.
Wow.
And, you know, this is the 80s. This is the late 80s. This is why I would go home for family stuff. And maybe family members would be like, study computers. Computers are good. You know, that's practical. So for my parents to give me that permission is a gift that keeps on giving, because I really have built a career based on following my intuition and really paying attention to what is the work that inspires me. So you're right, I did not set out to be a creativity strategist, but I have to say that I'm at a really magical moment in my life and my work for which I'm extremely grateful, where all of the varied meandering paths I took finally have converged.
Love it. Thank you so much. Mi gente, Dr. Nixon, she advises leaders on transformation.
She applies
wonder and rigor to amplify growth in their business and their value. She brings an innovative and unique perspective to every advisor engagement and leadership coaching session. So if any leaders out there of organizations are listening,
this
would be a great asset for you. She is also the author of The Creativity Leap, Unleash Curiosity, Improvisation, and Intuition at Work. And I found it so fascinating and so necessary for leadership these days. You know, the first question I want to ask is, you describe wonder as the beginning of wisdom. Can you tell me a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, actually, it was Socrates who said that wonder is the root of all knowledge. Maybe he said wonder is the root of all wisdom. And then centuries later, the Jewish theologian and civil rights activist Abraham Heschel, he wrote that it's wonder, not doubt, which is the root of all knowledge. And I really took great heart in that, because these are some really smart people. And this is dating back centuries ago, where very smart, thoughtful people are not saying that wonder that's up in the air and nothing to pay attention to. Instead, they're saying that you actually must start with wonder. You must allow your mind to wander. You must be committed to big, audacious, blue sky questions and the ability to be in awe of kind of the smallest moments and interactions to the most grandiose, right? Awe-inspiring ones. And that actually is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge, because it's through wonder that we begin to explore. It's through wonder that we begin to ask more questions. Spoiler alert for those who have not read the book, but it's not really a spoiler alert. The way I define creativity is that it's our ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems, where wonder is about audacity and curiosity and big blue skies thinking and dreaming, and rigorous focus, time on task, discipline, skill mastery. Over the weekend, we lost an incredible classical American musician, Ahmad Jamal, who was an incredible jazz music pianist. And he's an example, one of the jazz music artists that my father loved. And I grew up hearing Ahmad Jamal albums through my father's Blue Note collection. And then I started reading interviews with him. He had some incredible quotes about creativity. He said, there's no such thing as creative people. And I thought, what? What's he mean? And he said, we can only reflect creativity. We can't create snowflakes. We can't create the way the sun filters through the leaves. We can't create, all the wonders of nature. We can only go about the work and the process to reflect out that creativity. So it comes through, if you're an artist, it comes through your medium. I believe that we are all hardwired to be creative, whether you're an engineer, a coder, a farmer, a plumber, right? So he says, I don't think there's such a thing as creative people. We actually only reflect creativity. He said, there's only discovery.
Love it, and thank you for sharing that. So crucial. You, and very intuitively, start also making the case for creativity, about how relevant it is for the professional field, which sometimes, leadership and management doesn't see it that way. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes, I often say that there is a business ROI of creativity. In other words, there's not a fuzzy, soft, dotted line between creativity and business impact. There's a solid, bold line, especially because in the early years of building my company, Figure Eight Thinking, I would get invited into companies to help them build cultures of innovation. Everyone wants to innovate, which is fine. But I early on, I began to have this feeling that we're starting in the wrong place. Everyone's just clamoring to innovate, but it's like a dog chasing the tail, right? So I thought, well, I can't just critique this without giving some recommendations, some alternative ways to approach this. And I realized, I think that we should be starting with creativity. The challenge is, in most Fortune 500 companies, if I were to say, hey guys, I think we actually need to build our creative capacity, they look at me like I have three heads, because we don't actually understand creativity, especially in corporate business environments, right? We often only associate creativity with artists, the design team, people who work in marketing, advertising, which is totally true. Those are areas where we find immense creativity. However, I knew that someone like Albert Einstein was incredibly creative. The best engineers are super creative. To develop an algorithm is an act of creativity. And that sparked my work, my research, to figure out what's a simple, accessible way I could explain creativity and the business case for it. And so here's the business case for creativity. Because I think it is the engine for innovation, because what's an innovation? An innovation is an invention converted into scalable value. While it's still an invention, if it doesn't have cultural value, financial value, social value, it's not an innovation yet. But how do you go from the invention to that scalable value? That conversion factor is creativity. And so when we have companies, organizations, teams that commit to developing the creative capacity of the individuals on the teams, of the teams themselves, in other words, we give them the space and the time to dive into wonder and rigor and to toggle between them to solve problems. Here's just three examples of what begins to happen. When you commit to that, you require much more inventive thinking. You can't copy paste, right? So with inventive thinking, you begin to identify maybe new strategic partnerships. New strategic partnerships begin to disrupt the business model in a good way. And you identify new activities which lead to new revenue streams. And that new revenue stream is a business impact. So we can draw a line from inventive thinking to new revenue streams. That's the business impact. Another example, when we collaborate, we're really optimizing creativity. If I'm working on a project solo versus working on it with you and two other people with different skill sets, different backgrounds, we show up looking at the challenge with totally different questions. The more diverse the inputs, I like to say, the more innovative the output. So if we're honest, most of us hate collaborating. We do, because we think, we say, I could do this so much faster, man. Why do we have to bring in these people? They don't know what we do. We have to explain all this stuff to them. They're going to slow us, you know, all the things. However, short term, there is some learning curve, but your assumptions are challenged, right? You're asked great questions. And in that process, you begin to expand the ways you've been staring at the same challenge for the past year, 6 months, or quarter, whatever it is. So the other business outcome of committing to building a creative capacity is that we collaborate more. When we collaborate more, long-term productivity increases because efficiencies go up. Short-term, it's a learning curve, right? But when efficiencies go up, what goes down? Costs. That's a business impact. And then the final thing I would just say about the business impact, the business ROI of creativity, is that you must be obsessed about your customers' problems when you commit to building creative capacity. You can't settle for churning out the same products, services, and done for the past 17 years. And when you do that, you ultimately invest in incrementally increasing the value of the products, services, and experiences, and that also is the business impact. So that's just an example of the business value of creativity.
I see a lot of the role of empathy here, especially towards a customer. It also, reading between the lines, it reminds me of another guest from Being on Latino podcast. His name is Sam Ford. He who made the case for slow innovation. Companies should take a look at the long term when investing in R&D departments or the different creative teams. Because like you said, at the short term, is that, you know, experimental process, is that uncertainty, but the investment in the long run is going to pay off if you have the right team, of course, I assume.
If you have the right team, I agree with this person, because one of the challenges in a lot of corporations, they have kind of puttering start-stop approaches to building cultures of innovation. And that's because they haven't really built the runway that's needed for innovation to seed in a sustainable, consistent way. Innovation is a messy process. It is not neat. It is not a linear lockstep process that you can show on a pretty PowerPoint slide. It actually requires failure, because that really is the only way we can make mistakes. So what human-centered innovation approaches really require, and lean and agile, what those are really proponents of, is this idea of prototyping. Because when we prototype, you're allowing for those mistakes. You're factoring, you're building in the runway for those mistakes, but not over years. You want fast, dirty, rough draft mock-ups of the idea so you can learn quickly. And what that means is you can't be afraid to test out a conceptual, ugly, very rough draft version of the idea, not just internally with your true believers, but with real and potential customers who that will give you that instant feedback that you need to know in order to tweak it and build it out appropriately. So there is a way to, as we've heard this expression, fail fast and early, if you integrate prototyping. But you've got to build in the runway in terms of time, in terms of budget, to allow for the real innovation to occur.
Absolutely. And if I read you correctly, that implies that the room, time, and resources for iterative and reiterative processes need to take place. Am I right?
You're correct. Absolutely. Iteration is everything.
Thank you. There's another aspect that calls my attention. You make the case about giving room for inquiries, you know, and from both the internal part of the organization, also, you know, the customer. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that, please?
Making room for inquiry,
yes,
for questions?
Exactly.
Yes. Well, easier said than done, right? So I love that you're very bring up this question in a cultural context. So I'm African-American and I'm Gen X, Generation X. I was born in 1969, came of age in the 70s, was a teenager by the 80s. And culturally, you know, I grew up in an environment where my parents didn't welcome a lot of questions, right? It was like, this is the way to do it. This is my advice. I need you to do this, right? And if I were to question, it would be couches talking back, being fresh, right? So that's just the cultural context of parenting that I grew up in. Now, I understand why my parents were raising me in that way. It wasn't because they didn't want to expand my mind. It wasn't because they didn't want me to be curious. It's because from their perspective, from what they understood to be the realities of being African American and in the United States, sometimes it might be more punitive for me to ask too many questions than to do my best to be hyper observant and to do my best to fit in. From their perspective, they were doing me a major favor, right? So I think one of the things I've grown to appreciate as I get older, is that whenever you are on the margins of a society, for me, I fluctuate because of my gender or my ethnicity. For some sometimes it's because people, for their ability. It could be class. It could be all sorts of things, right? And I used to, in my 20s, I used to have my hands on my hips because I was so tired of being the only Black person in the room, the only Black woman in the room. And I thought, oh, you know, this is exhausting, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't until I had the incredible gifts and opportunity to live abroad. I was working and living abroad in Sri Lanka. And there I was exposed to work with incredibly smart Southeast Asian women. Some were Northeast Asian women, some Hong Kong, but mainly they were Southeast Asian women. And I would be part of meetings where I would observe them do something that was very familiar to me, which is they were able to run and manage meetings where whatever people's perceptions were about their abilities, about their stature, their status in the organization, they basically converted people's assumptions about them into positions of power. What I mean by that is they didn't force themselves on people, but I knew going into the meeting where they wanted the plane to land. And I would observe they would have a very congenial, very accommodating way to interact, mainly with white U.S. Americans. And they led with their femininity. Up and leave. Take a lot of courage just to they led with kind of whatever people's assumptions were, they converted them in a way by the time, end of the meeting, they had gotten their way. The deal was done in the way that they wanted to be done. I was like 29, 30 years old. And I learned so much from that because I realized there was something very familiar about that to me as a Black American woman. And so I've developed this kind of cult of boundary spanning, which is this idea that when you are on the margins, it's actually an asset because you have greater perspective, right? It's kind of like if you're in a baseball stadium, you're in the nosebleed seat. It's not ideal, but you also have the greater perspective and you can span boundaries in a way that it makes you much more agile. So I think that whatever the situation is in terms of your upbringing, in terms of the cultural context around, in this case, we're talking about curiosity and ability to ask questions. I, for example, became very nimble at spanning the boundaries between my home environment, the cultural context of how my parents were raising me to prepare me for adulthood. And then I ended up going to a very wonderful and elite Quaker prep school in Philadelphia, where the cultural context was like, ask a better question, ask forgiveness, don't ask permission, just shout out the answer. And I started there in seventh grade, I got so good at finishing the worksheet, getting the gold star, dotting my I's, crossing my T's, and all of a sudden I was in a very different culture of learning where it was about ask a different question, you know, push the boundaries. And so it was very challenging for me at first to try to figure out how to balance those two worlds. But we all have the ability to learn to catch on pretty quickly. And it's actually, and I'm the better for it because I understand both approaches. So I think that curiosity, it's not that if you grow up in a cultural context where, you know, maybe the adults in the room, if you're a child, don't really welcome the questions, that you don't ask questions. You learn to bury the lead. You learn to, it's not that your curiosity gets dampened, but you're still curious because you have to be so observant. And you learn to insert the question in a new and different way, maybe down the line instead of right up front. So I always just try to see the positive and the optimistic perspective of whatever position I'm in at the moment to understand what is the advantage that I have because of what I've had to endure or experience or now that what I'm bringing to the table.
So even in a position of what we perceive as disadvantage. We can still have a good perspective and broader perspective of the situation and bring value to whatever the situation may be.
Absolutely. Let's take women, for example, whatever your ethnicity is. There are certain preconceptions about you, perhaps as a woman, right? But because, and I, on top of that, I'm a woman of color. If when I walk into a room, I'm the only one, I'm one of a few, the advantage is I have developed the ability to be incredibly politically savvy. I have to observe within the first minute the power dynamics in a room. I have to be actively curious. I have to be deeply observant. I have to be very strategic in when and how I ask questions, right? Those are all things that actually are incredible assets. So that's what I mean by the advantages that come from what I call boundary spanning.
Such a new perspective, and remind me of how us dudes can learn about being more graceful when trying to be persuasive. You know, we're not big on that.
Yes. Yeah.
Lastly, and I think that this is the unique perspective. To me, it's like the golden fleece in this book is creating as a community. You know, we appreciate when collective flow emerges somehow, you know, and in that setting, you say that as a community, we can be a community of creativity. Can you expand on that, please?
Yeah, so I think that's the leap that we have to make, right? We have to commit to developing our capacity for creativity as individuals. But in order to move the needle in our families and our organizations that work, how do you get to the point where you're developing this community of creativity? And that really gets into integrating one of the frameworks I introduced in the book, which is the three I's. The three I's are the ways that you activate and sustain the ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. I realized I couldn't just tell people, okay, toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. Off you go, creative. Well, how do you do that on a daily basis without, you know, getting burned? How do you remind yourself to do it? How do you deal with other people? And so those three I's come into play, and they are inquiry, or curiosity, what you just asked about, improvisation, the ability to say yes, and the ability to be all about the build and not shut things down. And then intuition, which I think of intuition as pattern recognition. And where that comes into significance, when we're talking about building communities of creativity, is that we must be curious about the way other people do things, right? Why do they do it that way, not my way, right? We have to practice self-inquiry and then have the courage to raise our hand to ask questions, because the more diverse the questions or inputs, the more innovative the output. We must be willing to be very improvisational and be about the build with one another, which means to be experimental. So instead of when someone suggested a new or different way to do something, instead of saying, yeah, we tried that 9 years ago and it didn't work, or whatever the poo-poo idea might be, you lean in and say more about that. What are you thinking? Because it may turn out that they were thinking of a variation of the way it's been done before. The other thing to remember, even if it has been done 9 years ago, 17 years ago, in the external environment, lots of factors have shifted, which means the result will be a little different. So that willingness to improvise with one another, to be experimental with one another, I learned a lot by studying the ways jazz musicians work. And there's an incredible scholar named Frank Barrett, who's done a ton of work about jazz musicians and jazz improvisation and what corporations can learn from that. And so in jazz, there's no such thing as a mistake. It's all about the build. They really value those intimate hallway moments, or the moments on the tour bus, or the moments when they kind of, they're just playing around, right? So how do we build in those moments of playing around? All of that is related to improvisation and building cultures and community. And then lastly, the intuition is something that I believe we need to share and talk more openly about the ways that intuition plays a role in our strategic decision making, especially leaders, because when leaders are really honest, at least the 50 people who I interviewed for my book, The Creativity Leap, to a person, they acknowledge the ways their intuition, that nudge, plays a role in strategic decision making. So they have the Excel sheets and the data, but they also pay attention, they listen to that nudge that I should maybe go back to this conversation we have. Let's revisit that former competitor and see if they'd be open to a co-opetition model. So the three I's are really critical for building those communities of creativity.
I love it. And it reminded me that this last part about intuition, about the importance of not just spewing out data, but actually reading between the lines and see what's yes. beyond that, you know, what's underneath the surface. So thank you once again. I'm so grateful for you giving us some of your time. How can people follow you on social media, Dr. Nixon, please?
Yes. Well, again, thank you very much, Gonzalo, for inviting me to be a guest on your podcast. People can go to figure8thinking.com. That's F-I-G-U-R-E, the number 8thinking.com. And they'll have access to all sorts of cool stuff. They can download a free sample chapter of The Creativity Leap and also access some of the other podcasts that I've been on, some of my talks. Another book that I wrote before The Creativity Leap, a book I edited called Strategic Design Thinking, but lots of great information and free downloads are available at figure8thinking.com.
Once again, that was Dr. Natalie Nixon, author of The Creativity Leap. Thank you. Gracias, doctora.
De nada. Gracias a ustedes.